From KHOL, this is Jackson Unpacked, our podcast on news, music, and culture in Jackson Hole and around the Mountain West. I'm Tyler Pratt. Coming up on today's show, locals are working to showcase the immigrant experience in Jackson Hole, and that means highlighting the many Latin American cultures and backgrounds of the people here.
Me gustaría resaltar la diversidad cultural.
A photographer discusses her work now on display at the Center for the Arts. And a March Madness-style competition is underway for dogs.
People have very different opinions about which dog is the cutest or has the best expression or which dog speaks to your soul.
These stories and more coming up on Jackson Unpacked. Thanks for tuning in today. People living in and around the Tetons have shared in recent years they don't feel like their voices are being heard in Wyoming's capital. As the northwestern region becomes increasingly unaffordable for many, it's grappling with issues unique to here, far from where statewide decisions that affect local residents are being made. The town of Jackson is about a seven-hour drive from Cheyenne. That's if the weather cooperates. And even then, it's not always easy for residents to make the trek to get FaceTime with state lawmakers. So Jackson and Teton County officials have made it a priority to play a larger role in building relationships in the eastern part of the state and bring attention to the priorities of locals. And as KHOL's Dante Filpla-Ankney reports, at least for one town official, that's meant calling Cheyenne home during budget talks this year, aiming to try and help get the region some relief.
Driving away from the capital, Arne Jorgensen checks the road conditions as he heads west, across a snow-swept landscape, back towards the rugged Tetons.
These high grasslands in Wyoming are amazing. I never get tired of the view. I know a lot of people get dismissive of it, but I just find it's Wyoming, and it's something that I really appreciate.
The Jackson Council member and vice mayor spent over 2 weeks at the state capitol on the town's dime during the budget session, attending floor sessions, meetings, and conferences with state lawmakers. He is headed back to Jackson in a Subaru the town loaned him and says he's hopeful recent efforts to advocate for the region's local concerns will pay off.
Our current council recognizes the importance of making and building relationships around the state. So I feel good about it.
In years past, state legislation has been introduced that could have impacted Jackson and even eroded local government control, like a recent bill that aimed to make the Teton County Fairgrounds a state historical site, which could have affected the town's efforts to build more places for people to live. And in the fall, some lawmakers considered restricting the county's ability to provide affordable housing in a region with some of the largest wealth disparity in the United States.
I would say starting 5-6 years ago, there was a really strong recognition that we needed to be more involved as we were seeing more bills show up that were clearly targeted at Teton County, the town of Jackson. And we made a real effort there to commit to that.
Jorgensen says lots of Jackson Hole officials have driven to the large halls of the state's capital in recent years to try and have a stronger influence on state legislation.
A big point of discussion is local control. Leave decisions up to the elected officials closest to the people.
One new move that Jackson and Teton County made was to hire a pair of lobbyists skilled in networking and talking to politicians. Bob McLaurin used to be Jackson's town manager.
This whole lobbying game is about relationships. And it's something you do year round. It's not something you do in the 20 days of a budget session.
He now works with the Wyoming Association of Municipalities, an advocacy group for cities and towns throughout the state. He says paying for lobbyists is unique to Wyoming towns and counties, but in Jackson, necessary.
In Jackson, I think it's a prudent thing to do.
McLaurin says one big issue for Teton County residents has been property tax relief, which was a large subject of discussion this budget year. Rates have been spiking along with property values, which has contributed to the region's affordability crisis.
Increasingly, Jackson is a very, very important economic driver to state revenues.
And some residents may see some property tax relief soon, following the most recent legislative session. Also possibly resolved concerns around the much-talked-about Kelly Parcel, a piece of public land near the Tetons that could have been sold to developers. and local schools should benefit from more education funding. But Jackson and Teton County may still face an uphill battle as a blue island in a red state.
Wyoming has, over the last three decades, become increasingly Republican.
Jim King has spent over 30 years as a political science professor at the University of Wyoming. The majority of the state's lawmakers are Republican, and he says the party is fracturing.
You know, what you're seeing in this situation is a Republican, if you will, kind of the old guard versus the new guard. Wyoming legislature has, Republicans in the legislature have a Freedom Caucus that seems very similar to the Freedom Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives.
This recently bubbled to the surface on the first day of this session when the Freedom Caucus shot down 13 bills on introductory votes. Further divisions between lawmakers led to the State House walking out of negotiations with the Senate over a $1 billion difference in initial budget proposals. They came to an agreement on the budget in the end, but tensions may continue to mount later this year as election season ramps up, both here and across the country.
I mean, that's one of those things. I mean, this is not unique to Wyoming. There has been generally an increase in the nationalization of elections. You see candidates running for governor, candidates running for other state offices, running against the national party. Wyoming has fallen part of this national trend of seeing one party as in its interest and the other party is not.
Jackson Town Council member and Vice Mayor Arne Jorgensen says it's something he's seen firsthand.
The discussions have become less, I want to be really careful here, less civil. There are more people are staking out their positions in ways that don't necessarily leave room for a compromise or middle ground. It's clearly different.
But back in Jackson, after returning his loaner Subaru to the town, Jorgensen says he still thinks the new effort to build relationships at the state capitol has been successful.
You were able to talk about things that impact everyone in the state of Wyoming, something that is a real benefit, yes, to us here, but also statewide. So that was definitely just a different vibe. It felt good.
Wyoming is now less than a year away from the next legislative session that will kick off in January, and Jackson, Teton County, and the state may have new players at the table when it comes to future conversations about affordability, governance, and quality of life in 2025. Primary elections are coming up this summer, and the presidential election is this fall. Dante Fopala-Inkney, KHOL News.
Abortion access in Wyoming has been on the minds of many in the state over the past 2 years as legislators have repeatedly tried to ban many forms of access, and now the future of abortion care rests in the state courts. And this winter, Teton County residents temporarily lost access in the region along with other women's health care needs after one of the primary doctor's offices here closed. One of the medical professionals there has since started providing abortions again, working with St. John's. But in Casper, the only other abortion provider in the state, Wellspring Health Access has faced arson, a local backlash, and near-constant protest since it opened nearly a year ago. Now, a bill passed by Wyoming lawmakers aims to place new regulations on the only remaining clinic that provides procedural abortions left in the state. The governor vetoed the bill, saying amendments complicated its purpose, making it vulnerable to legal challenges. So, a new version of the legislation could come up again. Chris Clements reports on the uncertain future of the clinic.
The clinic administrator at Wellspring Health Access, Brittany Brown, got a text message from a number she didn't recognize. She was in bed at home.
This one gentleman chose to text me and let me know that if he were to ever catch any of our doctors, he would physically assault them.
For Brown and the rest of the staff, the threat was another in a long list of threats and setbacks Wellspring has experienced since it opened.
When I got hired here, I know violence is a possibility. I know legally shutting us down is a possibility. I know that there's a good chance that I may not have this job.
House Bill 148 would require the clinic to become a licensed ambulatory surgical center. Critics believe it's an attempt to keep abortion inaccessible in Wyoming if a pending legal challenge to a near-total abortion ban ends up succeeding. They say the bill is intended to force the closure of just one business, Wellspring.
Well, this is the lobby, obviously, where patients and their support people wait and hang out for us, try to make it as comfortable and cozy as possible.
Brown is giving a tour of the clinic.
We want people to kind of just relax a little bit once they get here, because of course, getting here can be quite the ordeal.
Next, we walk down a hallway that leads to the exam rooms. There's a framed sign that reads, "Keep your laws off my body."
This is our recovery room after procedures. Our patients come in here, the chairs recline, we give them a cozy blanket, a heating pad, snacks and drinks.
Wellspring provides a range of women's health services, including pelvic exams, cancer screenings, and procedural abortions for patients in Wyoming and in states nearby that have passed abortion bans. Brown says roughly half the patients the clinic sees are traveling from across the state and the country.
Anybody who's familiar with Wyoming knows that for a lot of specialty care, you better be planning on getting in a car and driving for several hours.
Once they show up at the clinic, protesters from crisis pregnancy centers in the area are often already waiting for patients at the edge of the property. Holly Thompson is a volunteer at Wellspring and a Casper resident. Every week, she and other volunteers escort patients from their cars to the door, often as protesters are loudly praying or shouting things like,
"Well, don't do that. Don't go in there because you're going to commit suicide later in life."
It's personal for Thompson. She had an abortion when she was 21, before Roe v. Wade went into effect.
And the reason I had it is because I was a first-year teacher, a brand-new teacher in Rock Springs, Wyoming, and women could be fired for being pregnant and not married before Roe v. Wade. I promised myself back then that if there is anything I could do to help women in the future, I would do that.
Deborah Cheatham is another volunteer. Her father was an OBGYN in Casper for years. Cheatham says he went down that path after a woman came to see him who was sick with sepsis. After she died, Cheatham's father asked the husband how she got sick.
And he said, "Well, she went to Mexico for an abortion." And my dad asked why she would do that. And the guy broke into tears and said, "We already have 6 kids. We couldn't afford another one."
In-office abortions performed at clinics like Wellspring aren't generally considered surgeries. But House Bill 148 requires clinics that provide procedural abortions in Wyoming to be licensed and equipped to do surgeries anyways. Representative Martha Lawley of Warland is the bill's sponsor.
We have a duty to regulate abortion for the health and safety of women in Wyoming who would choose an abortion.
Lawley's view is that as long as procedural abortions remain legal in Wyoming, bills like hers are necessary to ensure patient safety.
In the event of a botched abortion, it's important that there be a kind of continuity of care between the doctor who performed that abortion and the facility where that woman would be taken to for further care.
But Wellspring's founder, Julie Burkhart, says abortion is one of the safest medical procedures with a complication rate of less than 2%.
For Wellspring, we just did our statistics for 2023, and we are right there, right on target.
If 148 were to pass into law, Burkhart says she's concerned Wellspring might need to shut down some or all of its services, at least temporarily. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Jackson Unpacked from KHOL, where we showcase reporting and interviews on news, music, and culture in Jackson Hole and around the Mountain West. New episodes of Jackson Unpacked drop every other Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, your blood, it flows through my veins. Do you know my Indian name?
Jackson Unpacked is generously sponsored by the Snake River Sporting Club. At nearly 1,000 acres, this private western community accesses the Snake River and Bridger Teton National Forest, not to mention a golf course, equestrian center, and fully functioning ranch. More information about excursions, amenities, and lifestyle at snakeriversportingclub.com.
I have seen resiliency. Women sing their beautiful songs.
Northern Arapaho singer-songwriter Christian Wallowing Bull's new LP, My First Buffalo Hunt, captivates with its grit folk sound and reflects on life and the Wind River Reservation. He recently stopped by the KHOL studio to play some songs in advance of some local mid-March shows and joined KHOL music director Jack Catlin to chat about his sound, his new music, and perform some tunes. Head over to 891KHOL.org to hear the interview and songs.
My woman sings so lovely to me.
Thanks for tuning in to KHOL. I'm Tyler Pratt. March Madness got an early start in the Tetons, but it wasn't basketball teams in the brackets. It was dogs. Pets in Teton Valley, Idaho competed to be voted the most cute. KHOL's Hannah Mersbach sat down with the photographer who took portraits of the furry friends to raise money for a local animal shelter.
A Cocker Spaniel poodle nestles against Jess Curran, who's sitting on her living room couch in Driggs, Idaho. She's scrolling through her phone, looking at what she calls the pooch playoffs.
Okay, so game six. We have Olive on the left.
She points to a wide-eyed dog with droopy ears and a dark chocolate brown beard with a little gray in it.
She's a beautiful hunting dog, and she's very talented at tracking and pointing.
On the right is a puppy named Panda Bear, a St. Bernard poodle mix.
She has a beautiful, like, white stripe down her face and across her muzzle, and then she's black on the side. So she pretty much does look like a panda bear, which I think is perfect.
Olive and Panda Bear are going head-to-head in one of the first games in the Pooch playoffs, where voters can choose who's their favorite. How to pick? Curran says, go with your gut.
People have very different opinions about which dog is the cutest or has the best expression or which dog speaks to your soul, right? Like, I feel I love poodle mixes, and so I would generally vote for a poodle mix, probably because I have one.
As a boutique portrait photographer, Curran's clients are typically humans. It was her first year working with dogs, which she says was a learning curve. One trick to getting a good shot, peanut butter.
Because if you stick it, like, on their snout or, like, on the roof of their mouth, they'll spend a good, like, 2 to 3 minutes trying to lick it off. And that's when you get the really funny faces or tongue-licking photos that are just so cute.
The Teton Valley competition is happening alongside similar ones coast to coast, along with Canada and Australia. All these places are home to photographers in Curran's business mentoring group. They each photograph dogs in their town or city and put them in an online March Madness-style bracket, which will ultimately head to a face-off for who is the cutest dog in the world. Pet owners also get to take home the portraits and hang them on their walls, which Curran says is important to always remember them.
We get them for such a short amount of time, right? Like, we love these animals and they're such a huge part of our life. And unfortunately, the truth is that we will probably outlive them, which is so sad. But having that beautiful reminder of this dog and the joy that it brought to our lives in our home displayed so that we can see it often is really great.
If Teton Valley wins, a pot of money could go to the Driggs Animal Shelter, PAWS. Curran says she's already donated $2,000 to the organization since pet owners pay a fee to have the photos taken. And some shelter dogs also made the lineup.
And they are adorable, and I do not doubt that they will get adopted very quickly.
And a relatively new resident in Teton Valley, Curran says the project has helped her meet new people and feel more part of the community. Having dogs, she says, is a common denominator that makes for instant friends. For KHOL News, I'm Hannah Mersbach.
The St. Bernard poodle, Panda Bear, was voted out, but Olive, the chocolate brown hunting dog, won and now goes to compete for the worldwide title. You're listening to Jackson Unpacked. A new exhibit at the Center for the Arts focuses on the immigrant experience, titled Invisible in Plain Sight. Photographer Jessica Valdez features the portraits and stories of 14 immigrants from around the world currently living in Jackson Hole. KHOL's Emily Cohen speaks with Valdez about photography and the inspiration for her exhibit.
When I arrived here, I couldn't believe what a beautiful place I was living in. I thought it was a postcard, and my son was growing up, so I wanted, like, to have memories of the place where we were living. Photographs create moments to always remember.
Can you talk about the transition from photographing your family to photojournalism?
Well, I started taking pictures of myself, my family, my son, and then people began to see a little bit of the work we were doing, and they started hiring us for different events, quinceañeras, baptisms, etc. With photojournalism, I wanted to be able to give back to the community and to be able to demonstrate how Latinos are capable of doing many things. I focus on this because in Mexico, people think that we earn money very easily, and they don't see all the work that goes into earning a dollar. Voices JH gave me the opportunity to work with them as a mobilizer, and I started listening. Our mission is to help Latinos and other immigrants. Then people gave me a chance to hear their stories. I wanted to take their stories so they could see how strong we are, how resilient we are to change culture, adapt to language. And I wanted to show a little bit of that. That's why I got into photojournalism.
How has becoming a photographer changed you?
It has made me have a little bit more empathy for things that before I didn't think had value, and it has completely turned my life around because it has opened my mind. Because if sometimes you think that your story is kind of difficult, and when I heard all the stories of all the people who participated, I realized that my challenges are very small and that there is no comparison of my story with all the others I have heard.
What do you want people to take away from this exhibit?
Me gustaría resaltar la diversidad cultural.
I would like to highlight cultural diversity and this community's stories of resilience. I seek to promote understanding, empathy, equality, revealing the wealth and contributions that Latinos have brought to society.
How did you gain the trust of your subjects?
Well, I want to thank everyone for allowing me to be a part of their private space. It was a connection. They felt a trust with me. It just happened, and it was care between both parties and trust.
Do you plan to document this topic further?
Yes, I would love to be able to work with more people, if they let me, of course.
Are there other topics you hope to explore?
I think that for now I want to be able to focus on this topic. If at any point another opportunity opens up, yes, I'm open. But I would like to continue with this.
Is there anything else you want to share?
Yes, just thank you to all the people who are supporting this, to my husband, to Voices JH, to Lina Collado, to all the people who have helped and supported me. I want to thank all of you for your trust, and I hope to send a good message to everyone.
Jessica Valdez, thank you for speaking with me today. Jessica's exhibit, In Plain Sight, can be seen at the Center for the Arts in downtown Jackson now through April 30th, and there will be a discussion on Friday, April 26th. For KHOL, I'm Emily Cohen.
The sport of ice climbing is growing in popularity. Places like Teton Canyon are hotspots for locals, and now festivals and competitions are happening in communities around the United States. But by its nature, the sport hasn't always been accessible to everyone. However, as Laura Pomisano with KVNF and Colorado reports, that is changing.
It's a snowy morning in early February. Dozens of ice climbers are at the Lake City Ice Park for the town's annual ice festival. 29-year-old Derek Reamer of Louisville, Colorado, traveled nearly 5 hours to ice climb here.
I ski a lot, so I have to balance ice climbing with skiing, but it's a really fun thing to do in the winter.
Reamer is blind. He uses sound and touch instead of sight to help him climb.
Ice is very tactile. And you kind of can feel what's convex and concave with the ends of the tool because they're such a sharp point. It doesn't require a ton of visuals at all.
He also rock climbs, so he says ice climbing was a natural progression.
In ice climbing, I can make my own footholds for a lot of the time, and I can make my own handholds a lot of the time. Unlike with rock climbing, where you kind of are at the mercy of your holds, ice climbing gets rid of a lot of those variables, so it's in some ways easier to adapt.
Reamer is one of 9 adaptive athletes at the Lake City Ice Park today. He's part of a guided ice climbing trip with Paradox Sports. The Boulder-based nonprofit facilitates adaptive climbing opportunities. Paradox Sports instructor David Egan traveled from Seattle to Lake City to work with the adaptive climbers.
Well, as Malcolm Daly said so profoundly, show me what you got, and we'll go from there. So if I need to figure out how to get your tool onto your arm that doesn't have full function, we'll figure that out. If someone has, they're in a chair, we'll figure out how they can use their arms more.
Egan says outside of the guardrails of safety, everything in adaptive climbing becomes creative, and the point is to have fun.
We want them to walk away, wheel away, crutch away, anywhere they go away with something accomplished. You know, it's all about empowerment.
In 2021, Katie Nelson of Montrose, Colorado, suffered a spinal cord injury.
I was really fortunate that my injury is considered an incomplete spinal cord injury, so I have minimal paralysis.
Before her accident, the 33-year-old was an avid rock climber. She was determined to return to it.
Because I really, really wanted to get back outside and out doing the things that made my heart happy, I had that extra motivation to really do my PT, my homework, and all that work that came with it.
She's back to rock climbing, but in the winter, she now also ice climbs. Nelson started last year and says the sport has taught her some things.
I mostly have just learned more about how I want to use my body and how I can use my body to kind of compensate for what it's not gonna do anymore. This is a sport where no matter what, everybody has to use tools.
That would be ice picks and crampons.
Doesn't matter how many limbs you came with, what parts of you you can or can't feel, everyone starts on that level playing field of having to use the tools.
Sam Sala is the National Program Manager for Paradox Sports.
The Lake City Ice Park is, to me, probably one of the best accessible ice parks I've ever been to.
He compares it to the Ouray Ice Park just over the mountain pass. He says it's larger and logistically more challenging to access.
You start at the top of the gorge and you have to hike people down or lower them into the gorge. With people with physical disabilities, some of them have limited mobility. Getting down into the canyon and getting back out can be the hardest part.
Sala also says ice climbing in other areas can involve navigating difficult terrain or travel in the backcountry. That's not the case with the Lake City Ice Park.
Lake City, we drive up to the parking lot, walk 150, 200 feet, and we're at the base of just absolutely pristine, beautiful, steep ice. So it's not really any place like it.
Back at the ice wall, Sala stands below adaptive athlete Derek Reamer, offering guidance.
Swing that again, man. You're a little bit wobbly. Make sure you're really planting tools. There you go. Nice.
Back on the ground, Reamer says it's not just instructors who help out.
If you have someone in a wheelchair and you have someone who's blind, it might be the case that the blind person's pushing the chair while the person in the chair is guiding. We all help each other out, and I think the community is as important as the program itself.
This is his third ice climbing trip and second time at the Lake City Ice Park.
I had heard about ice climbing. I'm like, that sounds really scary. I should try it, though.
He offers this advice for anyone nervous about attempting the sport or any new activity.
Part of managing fear is having a progression to get better and being intentional about the things that you learn at any given point so that you're not doing too much at once.
Reamer says if you plan to try ice climbing, go with people who are experienced and can guide you. Reporting from Lake City, I'm Laura Palmisano.
That story was shared with us by Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public media stations in Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Wyoming. That's it today on Jackson Unpacked. Original music for the show is performed by the local band Strumbucket. I'm Tyler Pratt, and this is K2L Jackson.